The next case is 982456, Ormet Primary Lumen Corporation versus Employers Insurance Company of Outback. Mr. Brendel.
My name is Mr. Brendel, I represent Ormet Primary Lumen Corporation. First of all, I'd like to thank the board for the opportunity to address this distinguished board. I would like to reserve 3 minutes. This is an appeal from the grant of some protection motion. Effectively divesting appellate format of 16 years of both primary and excess insurance coverage by trial court finding as a matter of law, both late notice and prejudice as a matter of law. The environmental claims arise out of the store operations of Ormet's smelting operation.
Mr. Brendel, one of the procedural aspects that is important to me is that it seems that the real claim of the appellant here is that they ought to have had a jury trial. And inasmuch as the appellant filed this case as a declaratory judgment, which we know is asking a court to construe typically issues of law, and though, I look through your propositions a lot and I'm thinking which of these actually set forth an issue of fact within the legal question, which is the legal question is asking your client asked the court to construe a contract and the contract and the coverage. Now, within that, if there are truly issues of fact, of course, the declaratory judgment statutes permit issues of fact may be treated as in any other civil case. That's what the statute says. But we have to keep in mind in this argument that the application for relief was for a declaration of contractual rights.
The underlying action is both a breach of contract action and declaratory judgment action, as is typically the case in these insurance coverage disputes. We believe that in effectively making judgments as to the credibility of witnesses, and effectively weighing inferences, and effectively disregarding evidence, and finding that we breached the contract as a matter of law, and divesting us of our right to a jury trial, we believe that implicates the summary judgment standard for this court. We think it plainly does on the breach of contract aspects of the case. And we think it was improper for the court to reach that issue. Obviously, before this court, there are several important issues, including what standards to be applied with respect to the doctrine of prejudice in Ohio as applied to its policy law.
Before you go to that, let's get to the prejudice, because that's really the issue. How can you not presume prejudice when notice wasn't given in the case of, I guess, the primary carrier's 21 years and the supplementary carrier's 17 years?
Let's look at that issue here. We were found, as a matter of law, to have given notice late by a matter of 21 years. The trial court said notice should have been given in 1971. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
That's 9 years before the passage of the law which imposed retroactively the liability on Ormet. I mean, it's akin to the Hamilton Mutual case where the court recognized that when parental immunity protection was revoked, that that excused a delay in notice. Here, the court found as a matter of law we should have given notice 9 years before there was any basis for liability. Now, they will argue, well, that was the occurrence. But under Kibbett Industries, The appellate courts in Ohio found that in the environmental context, property damage occurs when there's some requirement to remediate, when some step must be taken to repair or restore the property. The mere fact of a release of contaminants does not give rise to an occurrence, certainly does not give rise to a claim until many years later. If you go to Informat facilities today, they are discharging at their out of fault contaminants into the Ohio River. It's entirely lawful. They are within permitted releases. If the law were made more stringent, if the legislature decided to ratchet down the permissible releases and made it retroactive, because that's what Superfund did. It made it retroactive and it made strict liability. Would the insurers now contend that we are barred from any claim of coverage because we didn't give notice of our releases at this time? It constituted contamination. The court has to be mindful of the fact that the decision as to the timeliness of notice was made at the time in the context of those facts. This was in the presence of.
You say from 1921, so gives you a heck of a lot of years. Reading the. Then doesn't an insurer, wouldn't somebody say, okay, I'm late on my notice with the carrier, I'll destroy all the evidence, and they can't prove anything, they can't prove that they were prejudiced because all the evidence is gone. Oh, I missed.
No, that's not the result. The result is that the insurer proves that they destroyed the evidence, and that is prejudice. They proved that they created circumstances which made it impossible for them to obtain a different result. They're in the business of handling claims. They prove it the same way they proved it in this case. They take depositions, they introduce facts, they introduce affidavits. If that's how they prove it, they were certainly able and capable of laying out their position on why they were prejudiced. We were equally capable of laying out our position on why we think that's not, why we think that is meaningless, why we think that was a pretext to defeat coverage, why we think they would never have conducted a meaningful investigation, why they would never become involved in negotiations with the environmental agencies or any of their insurers. And what that was presented.
Well, so, I mean, we think there's people there. That fact that they would not have even been notified, they would not have participated in this investigation.
Yes, Your Honor, I believe that fact has been established. I think that we introduced into the record a note of each one of their claims personnel was deposed and asked these types of questions. And fortunately for them, they had the resources to assume this heavy burden of rebuttal. And we met that burden. We had notes in the file that because this policy does not contain a pollution exclusion, you will have to find evidence of late notice, expected or intended, compromised settlement, volunteer payments. And I think a reasonable inference from that note in our claim file was that there was never any genuine interest in exploring the facts of coverage. There are 13 pending summary judgment motions other than this one to defeat coverage. I mean, this court well knows, these environmental issues are very contentious, and they're based on issues of law. The insurers here never intended to pay this claim without a declaratory judgment. And these aren't just statements of counsel. You know, we've come forward with the facts.
Was there, I take it that there was a jury demand written with this filing of this case?
Yes.
Okay.
The other issue that is escaped.
Let's go, before you do that, let's go directly to the contract of insurance, because that's really what concerns me. Having gone through a number of these, my own practice, with regard to the question of reservation of rights and serving timely notice and cooperation and all, your policies, at least some of them, said that you had to give notice as soon as practicable. Now, why was it only practicable at the time you finally did it, this number of years later, as opposed to being earlier?
I thank you for that question, because actually that's where I was going next, to the policy language. Right. We have these flood policies, primary policies, 12 years of coverage. The advocates of strict construction contracts, the amici advocates who suggest we should go back in time to an irrebuttable presumption, conveniently ignore the endorsement that defined what as soon as practicable means. It states, it shall be after an accident or suit becomes known to the insurance department of the insured. Now, Earl Wigand, the insurance department, the employee, the sole employee, the risk manager, was deposed and walked all around the paddock. And his testimony was that I didn't become aware of the circumstances giving rise to this environmental claim until shortly before notice was given. All of that was, that should then be inferred. Contractually that risk, and it is there to protect the company. A large company with claims are arising all around the company, they contractually agree that our notice obligation doesn't become right until the risk manager actually has knowledge. Mm-hmm. The insurance department actually knows. We introduced evidence that that wasn't so shortly before we were given notice, and that issue escaped any analysis or scrutiny in the two courts below.
Everybody concedes that should be a subjective analysis rather than objective, that it's this individual says he didn't know, or should it be a new or should have known?
I think when you have an endorsement that specifically imposes knowledge in a particular officer.
It did say an officer. Sure.
I think it should be subjective. And whether it's reasonable or unreasonable, even if you buy into a, kind of an objective standard, I think that's a trial issue of fact under the circumstances.
Aren't these policies of insurance and in the previous cases we've had on these issues? I've thought about that and wondered about it. I guess it's the best time to ask it. Aren't these policies of insurance designed to cover damages that you cause to other persons rather than damages that you cause to yourself?
That's correct. These are liability policies, and that's part of the whole difficulty in defining when notice accrues, because all of our early concerns in the record related to how this impacted our process water, because, you know, what was happening was
okay.
We were getting units. And the third-party claim did not arise until years later.
But if you concede these are liability policies for your actions against somebody else, isn't this an action against you, in effect, if there is an action against you for something that you've brought on to yourself? For instance, you've polluted the land. You put this stuff into the land. Now, why should they cover, and forgetting this sudden emergency and those occurrences and all the things we had, seems to be a liability policy protects me if I do something against somebody else, not if I do it to myself.
The courts have interpreted this, the environmental statutes relate to their claims brought by a government agency relating to the third-party liabilities. I believe in Ohio, the groundwater is deemed to be constructively owned and managed by the state of Ohio for the benefit of all citizens. I mean, there's a property right at issue in the groundwater, whether it's under, that makes it a third-party property right. These types of claims have been considered to have been damages. And that issue, I believe, was addressed in the Kippen. That issue was addressed by this court in Highbud.
But we didn't do very much with it in Highbud because I don't think we were sure that. That's right. There was a different issue in Highbud. But here you've got directly what you're telling me is, I guess, that the government versus ORMET is brings about the liability coverage.
That's correct. It's the government requirement to take steps to remediate environmental conditions in their capacity as custodian of the resources of the state and in the interest of the public health.
I guess that's the question I had is exactly what, assuming the coverage was given here, agreed to, what was your damage, what would you get from the company?
We have requested that the insurers are responsible for the cost of remediating the contamination to the extent and as required by the U.S. EPA.
That's right. So that's I guess because to follow up on Justice Douglas' question, that's because the remediation prevents damage to individuals, to people who would be damaged by the effluent, right? If it was not controlled.
I think there's two aspects. One is a necessary step to limit additional damage by having this plume of contamination continue to drip into other areas, and it's also an effort to restore the waters of the state to a certain level which is deemed acceptable. Interestingly, you know, we're not required, by the way, to take this water back to this pristine level. Which would also suggest that the notion that any contamination results in an occurrence is nonsense.
Well, but your answer, I guess, is the reason that the companies find some significance in the date upon which you knew how much it was going to, when ORMET knew how much it was going to cost to remediate. That's a critical, that becomes a critical date, I guess, does it not, if that's what you're looking for?
It's particularly critical with respect to the London insurers, where the notice really only arrives when we think it's going to impact those excess policies. Our position on the record is, simultaneously, while we were being obligated to undertake this Superfund action, you know, the company had its day-to-day regulatory issues with the state of Ohio and the EPA with respect to routine effluent compliance levels. Those issues were being ratcheted down as well. Now, our position is those documents related to regulatory issues and other things we were doing apart from this claim were conflated with the Superfund record and attached to a motion. We were never given oral argument or even the opportunity to say that those estimates don't apply to our what we're actually being asked to clean up under Superfund. Those apply to some new law with respect to stormwater runoff that was being passed. They apply a certain effluent discharge.
Well, but if you're just stop it, to, but if you're if your damages are the cost of remediation, why doesn't the practicable notice requirement at least begin when you have some idea of what it's going to cost to remediate?
I think that it does begin, particularly with the London Excess Insurer Jar. I'm not disputing that principle. I'm just simply saying on the basis of this record, those estimates that you see in the record, we contend that those related to a different set of environmental obligations that are not at issue in the Superfund, that they were taken out of context. That is our position. I see that my time is up.
Thank you, Mr. Brendel. Mr. Eddy.
Sort of property damage that a liability carrier would have to be concerned about. It seems to me the context of this case is, how could the notice have been any later than what it was? How could there be any greater prejudice than what's been sustained on this record?
I find the language of the policy interesting. The policy states, as soon as practical, when the occurrence covered hereunder is likely to involve this policy. Now, you're stating that the occurrence occurred in the 70s when they first discovered the water had been contaminated. If that were the case, then why would the language just say 6 years from notice? Why isn't the language of the policy more precise? It appears to me using this imprecise language tends to support your adversary's position that much more has to occur before an occurrence actually happens.
I would point out, Madam Justice, that the language you're referring to, I believe, is with respect to the excess policies of Lloyd's, which Lloyd's
what is the language of your
addressed. This is written notice. This is for an occurrence. Now, written notice sufficient to identify the insured and reasonably obtainable information shall be given as soon as practicable. And this is a term that's been construed.
It's almost the same language.
This is a term that's been construed by many courts as defining within a reasonable amount of time. And the question is, when did they know of this property damage, of this groundwater contamination?
I believe that there's so many things involved in this type of situation. This is something that just occurs at a definite time.
Well, We do know in 1971 the groundwater that they were pulling out of the ground using Prospector Black. And we do know that they contained 10 parts per million in cyanide, total cyanide. Well in excess of drinking water standards. And from that moment on, at the highest levels of the threat, for two decades, they were dealing with a substantial groundwater contamination problem. They dealt with this in all areas of their business, in engineering, the hiring of outside consultants, their bankers, their accountants, their auditors.
But does it matter that they...
All of them, but their insurers they dealt with.
Okay. Does it matter that the loss person, whoever we're just talking about, that, and he's apparently set forth in the policy that he didn't know, isn't... And get to the issue of fact, please.
Yes.
The whole point is summary judgment.
The problem with the aforementioned contention with respect to Lowe's policy endorsement is that two of the insurance managers that were around in the 60s and 70s were deceased. We don't have any testimony about what they knew or didn't know. Mr. O'Wigan, who testified, didn't become the insurance department manager until 1979. And I must point out that it was actually the tax and insurance department. This is not disputed. And the head of the tax and insurance department was the controller of the company, Larry DuBois, who testified and who told us under oath. He attended board of director meetings where this very issue of groundwater pollution was discussed in 1973 and thereafter. So, you know, there is no disputed issue that the insurance department, in that sense, the head of the tax and insurance department, the controller, knew about it all along. And besides this Eastern case, which I would commend to the court, specifically says that this very sort of endorsement dealt with identical language does not relieve the company of a duty to inform its insurance department of those facts that are relevant to the performance of the insurance department's corporate task. It had a continuing duty to keep its insurance department informed of relevant corporate activities so that it could advise its insurers. In fact, the insurance department, the tax insurance department, knew about this. The entire corporate hierarchy.
Let me stop you there. So it's your contention that when somebody in the company who has responsibility realizes there's contaminated groundwater, that the insurance company should be advised of that?
That is the occurrence. That, in other words,
why is it the occurrence? Because there could be damage to third parties resulting from that, or property damage resulting, or
correct. And so the whole idea of getting prompt notice of a policy occurrence, we haven't talked about a claim yet.
That's immediate notice. You got notice of a claim, you must give immediate notice to your insurer. Ormet is placed on the national priorities list nominated in 1985. Now this is, those are the sites that are the most disastrously polluted in our country. Now when you're put on the NPL, you know that you have an extremely serious legal problem.
On that point and the other ones you're talking about, there's so many briefs here, I can't remember where I read it, but I think it was in your brief, that you indicated that they knew about this and for some reason, I get the feeling, clandestinely concealed it from somebody's brief, and I think it was yours, that says that they just didn't tell it for corporate reasons, they wanted to keep it quiet. Did you say that in your brief?
Essentially.
Yeah, I thought so.
The facts came out, there were some what I would refer to as smoking gun documents from the early 70s, where they were specifically internally talking about the cyanide contamination of their groundwater, and yet there are fluid reports to the state about what they were dumping into the river, that they were pulling out of the groundwater, which contained cyanide, in which they are then dumping directly to the river. In their reports to the state, there is no mention of cyanide, yet their own witnesses conceded that groundwater that they dumped to the river did contain cyanide.
Your colleagues are getting nervous, so let me just ask one quick question before you sit down. There's no case law out of this court that says general liability policies cover these kind of occurrences, is there?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. There's no
case law out of this court. You said there are a number of other court cases in the state.
I'm not aware.
I don't think we've ruled on it directly, have we?
I'm not aware of any decision by this court directly ruling on the substantive coverage issues. I would respectfully ask, on the basis of the Court of Appeals and the trial court decisions, that the judgment here be affirmed.
Thank you, Mr. Rudy. My question is,
be 5 minutes at least.
Once they don't notify you timely, are they just done with respect to everything that ever occurs out there on this property? In other words, pollution is an ongoing matter.
Shouldn't be.
So is your policy language in the position that you're just out of the case if they didn't tell you about these first horrible things that you should have been notified about? Or do they still have a plan that's going to be up to engineers to sort out what's in and what's out?
Early notice of a policy occurrence or claim is to allow the insurer to come in and take control over that litigation, administrative litigation, or control over that process early on. If you have an occurrence but not get a claim, it allows the insurer then to take the action with the insurer so that you never get to the claim stage. That's one of the evils that happened here, is that there was never any addressing of this problem at the earliest stages before the actual claim came down in the mid-1980s at the latest. I would say that with respect to what you say, there's not enough. This court, I think, has issued in the past a no prejudice standard. And I'm not suggesting that the court say once notice is late, that's the end of it. This court has seemingly engrafted a prejudice issue that this court is also in the Ruby case, which we haven't discussed, but the court is well aware of it. Utilize the presumption of prejudice, although not the syllabus of the court. And I think that is probably the better position to take here, that once notice of an occurrence or claim is untimely, then there is a presumption of prejudice to the insurer. And the insurer, in all fairness to the insurer, given the lateness, ought to then bear the burden of showing the absence of prejudice. No material witnesses gone, there's a dozen of them here, no lost documents, there's plenty of them lost here. No changed site conditions, there's no opportunity for the insurers to come in and investigate the site 2 decades after the fact to determine what? When did this property damage occur? That's the key policy.
Do you dispute Ornette's position where they say that they had ongoing, they were trying to take corrective measures since 77 Isn't there evidence of that in the record?
I would say this, and this is very fact-specific. In 1973, Ornette's board of directors was told by its own engineering department, I'm reading from what was presented to the board of directors in March of 1973, groundwater pollution is caused by rainwater leaching through the potliner piles. Covering the piles will stop continued aquifer contamination from this source. They estimated the cost was $250,000 to put a cover over the potline piles to stop continued aquifer contamination. Never spent, never done. 20 years later, they have a $30 million problem on their hands. That's impressive.
Council, again, before you sit down, Chief, this case, cases like this, some corporate complex fact issues. I think it is not unreasonable to assume that companies such as this, when they discover that they've got bad things going on out there, may or may not have first tried to handle it themselves, thinking the best way of mitigating the whole damage issue is to keep it quiet, legally or illegally, so you get all of those public policy issues mixed up in this. And at some point in time, the cat's out of bed, and then everybody knows. But from a precise engineering standpoint, may or may not be possible to identify what things occur later on, what damages occur later on, what damages occur within time windows to your company. So that's what I'm asking. There is no precise language that says once they've failed at all, that they're just out forever on any claim.
The notice provision with respect to a claim says immediate notice, and it's to provide the opportunity for an insurer, primary insurer, such as my client.
But your position really is to shut down any claim for financial assistance from your company, even for those matters that they could prove happened after or within a reasonable period of time from before the notice that they gave it.
If events had taken place, which then placed the insurer in an impossible position where they could no longer defend the claim, or in this case, they entered into a settlement agreement with the Ohio EPA 9 months before they gave notice, they entered into a written contractual settlement agreement with the Ohio EPA to design, build, and operate the very wastewater treatment plant that they wish their insurers pay for, not only the cost of it, but future costs. But that's a cost that they already entered into a settlement agreement on. So, if an event has occurred that prevents the insurer from having an opportunity to do its own investigation and determine whether that's an appropriate cost that ought to be incurred to pay for, then prejudice has occurred.
Your position is, due to failure of notice, there are no events that can happen for which we should be responsible.
In the facts of this case, given the passage of time and all the regulatory events that occurred decades before we got notice, it was already a done deal. And our contract specifically say, you got to give us notice and give us an opportunity to be able to stay at the end of the event. You can't do that if you don't get notice.
Thank you, Mr. Eddy. Ms. Keith Walker. And disregard the red light, both sides need more time than 15 minutes, so just start talking and I'll tell you when to stop.
I'll try to speak much more carefully. I think what's most important for this court to know is that this is not really a case about summary judgment, and this is not really a case about presumptions of prejudice. This is a case trying to redefine what prejudice is in terms of comparable outcome standards. In other words, actual prejudice occurs only when we can prove that our outcome 15, 20 years later would have been better than their outcome 15 or 20 years later. There's no standard, no precedent for this comparable outcome standard of what is prejudice by any other jurisdiction or this court. The test is what is prejudice in the process. Who made those decisions, how to remediate, whether to make, whether to pay the money, whether to disclose, what to the authorities? Who had control of the remediation? And when there are documents missing that are material to those decisions, where the people who made the decisions are deceased, where decisions were made that gradually reduce your options to a single outcome after 15 or 20 years, then there was prejudice. If you have a comparable outcome test, you're actually encouraging polluters to keep polluting and not tell anyone. Because the further along you go with the polluter making the decisions, with the shareholders' interest in mind, with all of those public policy considerations you were mentioning, Justice Pfeiffer, their interests are different from the insurers.
Well, but it's a question of who pays. It's not. I mean, they've agreed with EPA that they're going to build this treatment plant. That means they're committed, with the government saying you must be committed to clean up your water. That's going to happen. And doesn't matter whether the insurance company pays for that or they pay for it, does it? Isn't your statement a little over, haven't you overstated that point, I guess?
The first time that water treatment plant was recommended as the one solution to all their problems was 1971. How many cyanides and fluorides percolated through those unlined hot liner disposal pumps between 1971 and 1992?
Well, but with the insurance company's position saying, and I want to ask you to explain this, that you're not covered, Ormet, how would notice the insurance companies have changed anything? No cyanide would have been, cyanide would have still gone in the water, wouldn't it? So they, in 1971, they say to Globe and to Wausau that we've got this problem. And the companies say, well, that's too bad. We've read our policies and you're on your own.
It's a liability policy.
It's a liability policy.
Yeah.
And that's
nobody's been hurt yet.
Right. And that's because, and Ormet is folding in these issues of investigation, what investigation would have been done, what coverage would have been provided, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, all would have. In terms of this court formulating a policy or notice that insurers must follow, must separate those issues.
I agree. But the second issue is what would have happened had, what's the damage to the company? That's the second issue.
And we don't know. It's all speculative. And it's that very speculative nature of it that is the prejudice itself. If we know what happened without knowing, we don't know what would have happened. Would a coverage determination have been made much, much earlier? Yes. Would the insurance companies have made the investigation of site conditions, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that would have allowed them to know which year cyanide and fluoride were going in, how much were going in, who else was putting them in, all of those things could have been done, and the results will never be known. And that's what's so hard to focus on in this case. When you've got 15 or 20 years spanning, the speculation becomes ever greater.
Does your argument with regard to the prejudice amount to an irrebuttable presumption?
No. There are three basic tests this court could apply. One is the irrebuttable presumption test. One is the presumption, rebuttable presumption test. And one is simply the insurer must present evidence of actual prejudice. Thus far, this court has taken the middle road of the presumption of prejudice, which I believe is the one that is most rational and most recognizes the duty to both parties under the contract.
Well, if we take the position, the middle road, and you say that's what you're arguing, rebuttable presumption, isn't that then for a fact finder to determine as opposed to the judge?
Depends on how you define presumption. If you define presumption in terms of more material or evidence that's material to the claim gone, or witnesses material to the claim gone, and most importantly, or actions taken or decisions made material to the claim, then that in itself is prejudice, because then it becomes speculative as what would have happened if someone else had made those decisions.
Can there ever be a valid, irrebuttable presumption?
I do believe it can be, considering considering how unreasonable the delay is and what excuse is given.
That's why I was asking.
I've been waiting a long time to hear why the delay was so long in this case, and I still haven't heard an answer to that question. When you've got 15 or 20 years, the greater presumption is appropriate to place a greater burden on the insured to show that this unreasonable, unexcused 15-year delay was.
So you're kind of saying that if the presumption or if the prejudice is so pervasive that it becomes a matter of fact and therefore is irrebuttable?
I would say that right, you get to the point of the presumption itself becomes irrebuttable.
That's what I'm talking
about. Whatever the actual fact, and that's the end of the case. It's quite frankly not unlike the Wagner versus Rush case that I had the privilege of arguing last December. There, the issue of the two issue and whether or not it's prejudicial when a claim goes to the jury that shouldn't go to the jury and another claim goes to the jury that won. Part of this, the majority opinion of this court said, well, we're going to look at the facts of what went on at trial to decide whether the presumption of prejudice should apply. And the minority opinion said, well, we should, it's always inherent when you have a claim go to the jury. Now, if you look at the facts of what happened, the length of time over this 20-year period, and this is undoubtedly a case where a presumption applies, not only a presumption, but likely an irrebuttable presumption because of speculation. So
you finally got there, didn't you?
I think I learned quickly.
Not so well. You've made some persuasive arguments about an early on determination of coverage. I think it's safe to assume from what's been argued here so far that all of the insurance companies, part of their position is there is no coverage. Was not, is not, not for the reasons we're talking about here today, but it's just outside of what we insure. Is that correct? All of the insurance companies, that's their last line of defense,
and
first line.
And our argument is that we would have been able to make that argument much more effectively if we had known 15 years.
So you would have been in court with the determination of the declaratory judgment action to determine coverage. But you're
right.
Had you received notice?
Oh, had we received notice, it may well have led to a declaratory judgment action many years ago.
Presumably, given the posture that all the insurance companies have taken, that this is covered by policy.
And that declaratory judgment action could have been in terms of allocation among the different policies, in terms of triggering the excess, all sorts of issues. Including
but,
basic coverage.
But basic coverage is something that no one has conceded at this point, correct?
I think that's true.
Now, as we look at this overall picture and the importance of errors, and the application of what we do here to many, many other sites, it's also true that the posture of government has been changing throughout this 20-year time to tougher regulations and then, in some cases, backing up and saying, look, if we go that far, then we will have former manufacturing sites which are just totally useless to us. And so there is this balancing, I'm not sure of the term you are for the brownfield legislation and the levels of remediation. So you have this dilemma that your insured is faced with as well. They trick notice. Now you're in court. Now it's all public. I mean, you don't go to court with this declaratory judgment action and not have these issues become public and communities as they operate. Where, in some cases, waiting may, not in this case, probably, some cases, waiting may end up with the result that because the nature of the pollution is such that it's not migrant, the government's posture changes again and no remediation is required 20 years later, where 10 years ago, perhaps a great deal of intervention would have been required. Can you just comment on that generally as to how that should play out on these issues of the roads?
There are several answers there. First of all, I'm glad you said it's not in this case, because there's absolutely no excuse for waiting in this case when you recognize remediation is necessary as an internal company policy. One answer is that, at least under the excess policy, and you heard the language earlier from Justice Resnick, it says you have an obligation to notify us when the damages from the occurrence, assuming liability, are likely to be beyond the primary limits. So the insurer is supposed to assume that there's liability in all of these situations. And why does that make sense? Because when you're an aluminum smelter and you're heavily regulated by the Ohio EPA and the US EPA all along, you know when you've got a situation that you yourself are required to remediate, that is one that you are likely to, at some point, be found liable for. Now, and that's why many courts say recognition of the need to remediation or taking some remediation action itself is the quote-unquote liability standard that triggers. Now, in this case, recognize, for example, the excess insurer policies were triggered in 1976. In 1975, their internal memorandum saying, gee whiz, you know, we better not challenge our discharge permit with the Ohio EPA, because if we do, they might find out about all these nasties, and we may be liable for civil and criminal penalties. So we know that a year, and then in 1976, their own people were telling them, you know, assaulting a wastewater treatment plant would cost them $3 million, which is well in excess of $1 million liability. So here, you have a situation where you've got a heavily regulated company, environmental compliance is something they know about since they started up operations. They know that they've got potential liability to the Ohio EPA as it is, and yet they're saying, well, we didn't know that the United States EPA was going to put us under a Superfund, so therefore we had no notice to trigger liability. Now, I understand that you're concerned about a general rule in these matters, and what most cases under this, because remediation is so important that it be undertaken as soon as possible, is that when remediation becomes a recognized possibility, then you know you've got a damage that requires money, an occurrence that requires money to fix. At that point, you have an obligation to notify you.
Counsel, with what you know now, had you been notified 16 years ago, would you have covered this claim?
Because no matter what investigation we do now, it is going to be speculative as what would have happened or what we would have done had those witnesses been alive, had those more documents been available, had those decisions not been made not to put tops on the hotline.
In reality, notice is just a part of the problem.
I'm sorry?
Notice, proper notice, is just part of the problem.
Proper notice is the root of the problem. Because we weren't given notice 15 years ago, all of these other things occurred.
But aren't you just saying that because of one thing that wasn't done, we're not covering any of it?
Oh, no, Your Honor. We're saying from the whole host of things that weren't done. A water treatment plant that wasn't built, potlines that weren't covered, consultants fees that were consultant recommendations that weren't met. The inability to go back despite conditions changing,
well,
the inability to go back.
Isn't it pure conjecture that without notice, any of these things would have been done anyhow? If you had notice back then, you say you would have gone in and cleared up the whole problem. Is that really true?
I don't know. I mean, Your Honor, I don't even know what this insurance company's policy was in 1976.
Does the coverage that they had at that time encompass all those things that you're talking about? Helping them clear up the problem? Is that really right? I thought you were there to cover any damages that they may be liable to pay. I didn't know you went in and just helped them run the company.
What I know that we had was a right to ask those questions, a right to have the notice to investigate in a timely manner. And that's a valuable right, not just to determine if we're going to deny coverage, but to evaluate the primary, know what the primary limits are, evaluate the claim, set reserves, set future premiums. Insurance companies are incentivizers too, like courts. I mean, insurance companies can go into to plants and say, you know, you've got to get a safety program in because you've got all of these problems here. But if we don't know about what's going on, we can't do...
It appears to me that you're saying that because of the length of this delay, it's over. You aren't willing even to take that step to determine whether there was prejudice because you say it's impossible to determine because of the length of time. It's kind of circular reasoning.
I think that is an argument, Your Honor, and I also think that if you, under the facts of this record, you could take one of several trigger dates, and you could take one of several years of prejudice, and under whatever test you apply, you come up with an affirmance, unless you do the comparable outcome test, which no one has ever adopted.
Counsel, the posture of the case is at this point, your client and the other insurance companies are just out of this for everything, including matters that may have occurred recently. And presumably the company could prove these are items of damage to the environment that
That's the threshold.
That's right, Your Honor. There were mediations that Orman agreed to do, and which I believe is now done. He's not something that is an insurable event 20 years after the occurrence.
And there are no possible issues of damage that occurred recently for which are they forever
not for the damages that they claim, which is for the period of about 1960 to 1970.
I guess another issue is what was the length of
this covers
the term of coverage.
The excess insurance policy under which Heinzerman, I believe, covered from 1960 to
1973. That's the time frame of the loss.
Right.
And going to something that they're up to,
cut off in 73.
I understand. The policy issues that they have a policy.
And you're no longer insured.
No, no, that's the policy.
Do we insure, other policies, 73 all the way up to 92?
Yeah. Liability and property.
I do not insure. Sorry. I don't know if any or all of the insurers continued insuring Orbet after 1973, but no claims were made under any policy after 1973.
Thank you, Ms. Keyes-Walker. Mr. Mash, you have a minute.
May it please the Court, I'm just going to address some specific issues as it relates to my client, Wausau. I think that Justice Douglas pointed out that he's concerned with specific policy language in all policies, and I want this Court to recognize the fact that the language contained in the Wausau policy is the type of language that the courts of Ohio have determined that it requires notice to be given within a reasonable period of time under the facts and circumstances. As a matter of fact, Ormet concedes that test to the Wausau policy in its brief. Ormet further concedes that the test to be applied to the reasonable person, to the test, is the objective reasonable person standard. There's nothing in the Wausau policy that would allow were meant to try and point to the subjective beliefs and perceptions of some of its employees that have somehow impact the reasonable person test. And finally, I would also point out that ORMED concedes that the notice language contained in the Wausau policy is intended to afford the carrier the ability to, among other things, look, investigate, and formulate coverage defenses. And that's one aspect of this case that I think really is worthy to focus on. We lost the opportunity back in 1971, had we been put on a notice back then, to take a look at evidence in order to determine whether or not there are substantive coverage defenses that may apply in this case. All of our policies have expected and intended basis to exclude coverage. We are, because of the way notice was given in this case, we are now asked to try to look back 20 years in order to determine whether or not ORMED was in a position to expect the type of damage to specific remediation for which we are all here today. By virtue of the fact that we have missing witnesses, we have missing documents, and we have memories through deposition testimony that are faded, especially crucial witnesses on the Water Committee, we've lost the ability to formulate a viable defense.
On the question of whether Wausau would cover this damage or this issue, what difference is that in what somebody in the company thought about the water quality? If it's an issue of property damage or damage to third parties, you don't need to know what company officials thought about that back in 1972, do you?
That's exactly correct. And again, these are creatures of construction of words. And the words in the policy say that when you get a claim, you've got to give immediate notice. The words in the policy say that when you have an accident, you have to give a prompt notice. This is what the contract requires. Of course, the pilot will determine that notice provisions constitute precedence, conditions precedence to coverage of policies that have been upheld by this course in numerous positions. And Wausau would respectfully submit that reasonable minds, reviewing the facts of this case, can only come to the conclusion that there was a late notice and there was, in fact, prejudice. And we would further submit that these reasonable minds can most easily reach this conclusion when looking at the Wausau language.
Thank you, Mr. Mayor. Mr. Brindle, you may take a minute. Start with a minute for rebuttal.
ORMED is not asking the court to adopt a new standard. ORMED is not asking the court to adopt a comparable outcome standard. We are willing to accept the standard that is applied and should be applied to all policyholders here. Now, the issue of notice in this case is complex and difficult, and it becomes exceedingly more difficult to defend late notice as you move down that continuum. But where you draw that line, if the fact finder decides to draw that line, ripples through the whole notion of prejudice. It then defines what was a witness truly missing. I mean, there were people that they claim were prejudiced by who died in the early 70s, who died years before the statute was passed imposing liability upon us, who under no reasonable construction would want to find a duty to give notice at that point in time. So
Mr.
the whole area is rippled through in that regard.
Mr. Brindle, let me interrupt you. I guess I had the same question as Ms. Keyes Walker had. Maybe I missed it. A lot of reading here with them, but I guess I haven't seen a real clear statement as to why ORMED did not give notice to its insurers earlier than it did. Is there a golden nugget in here I missed that tells me that?
I think with respect to the growth policies, the answer is, I think it's respect for all the policies. The answer is because the risk, it didn't become apparent to the risk manager that there was a basis for a claim here. And you've got to put this in the historical
Well, certainly
context.
When you're ordered to remediate, build a plant, I mean, what's he doing, sleeping, or what?
What is the risk manager's job?
Well, certainly at that point, I mean, I don't want to argue with you, but just seems to me that at that point...
These were the questions that were presented to the risk manager. And in fact, may find his testimony not to be credible on those issues. But I submit we are not asking that the insurers be divested of their opportunity to prove their prejudice. What we are asking is that we not be divested of our opportunity to rebut their claims of prejudice. And all of that all of that turns on this issue of when would it have been appropriate, and more importantly, and notice this difficult issue of how do you escape the prejudice issue? Relates to the risk manager and some outside broker as to whether these types of claims are covered or not. The risk manager went into the environmental person asking, do we have these types of claims? And there was some issue where he was told no, or it's not applicable to our facts, or we haven't gotten to that point. But there are issues there.
But had you notified the company, all those questions would be answered. You would find out whether they're covered.
That's correct. Yeah. Would I prefer that they had given earlier notice? Should they have given earlier notice?
Of course you do.
Absolutely.
You don't have ideal facts there, do you?
Yeah, but I obviously think that the timing of that and whether they've actually been prejudiced. I mean, we have had some remarkable concessions here that I'd like to highlight. I mean, earlier notice results in an earlier denial of the claim.
But they have a right.
Arguably,
they have a right to do that, don't they?
Does that constitute prejudice? I don't think it does.
It's easier to deny it now than it was back then.
We lost the opportunity to say no earlier in time.
Let me raise the prejudice that
is completely lost. And I asked the Tiger. All they lost was 16 years and saying no, it's not covered. Where is their prejudice? They wouldn't have covered it then, and they don't cover it now.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised for opinions. We'll take a brief recess.